Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the curated online cinema. For your 1 month free trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
I live in a town called Millhaven, and it's small, and it's mean, and it's cold. But if you come around just as the sun goes down, you can watch the whole thing turn to gold. It's around then that I used to go a-roaming, la 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 la, la la la. Oh, God's children, they all gotta die.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today for our 201st episode, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
We also have Michael Snydell.
Hello again.
Hello. You know, this is like your third time on, and I've never bothered to ask, do you prefer Michael or Mike?
Honestly, I don't care.
Would you, like, are you fine with me just calling you Snydell?
Sure, if you want.
Okay, you're not making
deeply offended.
Our opening music today is from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, their album Murder Ballads, and it is The Curse of Millhaven, which I have chosen today purely because the movie we're talking about takes place in a town called Millhaven. And throughout the entire film, there was a certain, shall I say, tonal dissonance going on in my head. Because, and this is a weird segue, but I love this song. It is purely about a series of murders that happen in a small town that are perpetrated by like a 12-year-old girl.
That's a damn good album.
It's so good. It's so awesome. And I just kept thinking, like, I could do Puff the Magic Dragon. I could do Imagine Dragons. That would be terrible. Mm. And then I thought, you know what? Screw it. Let's go with The Curse of Millhaven.
Well, because of that thinking,
one pure surface similarity.
I was thinking you could do a Burning Ring of Fire as well.
That would work. There's a lot of options that I could have gone with. And this is probably the strangest, and I'm fine with that. Maybe we'll do Burning Ring of Fire for the end.
Isn't there like a 15-minute song at the end of this album? That's
this is like
just
a
about...
7-minute song, yeah.
Yeah. No, but
so
at the end,
listen to the whole thing. We'll fade it out eventually. Today, on the Film Stage Show, we're going to be talking about Pete's Dragon.
The perfect
companion for The Curse of Millhaven. That is the new movie directed by David Lowry, who previously did Ain't Them Bodies, Saints. It stars Bryce Dallas Howard, Wes Bentley, and Oakes Begley, or Feigley. I am honestly not sure. And that is it. That's all we're going to talk about, because as you all know, we no longer do discussions on this. We save that for our roundtables. If you're eager for another one of those, you're in luck, because we're going to have another one this week. So tune in for that. I should tell everyone there at home that you can talk to us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can also find us on the Facebook, the many-faced book. Just search for the Film Stage Show. And of course, you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. In addition to that, if you have any long-form stuff you'd like to talk about, you can always, always, always talk to us by reaching out podcast@thefilmstage.com. Today's episode, let's fade out the murder song before I do our plug. Today's episode is sponsored, as always, by the fine folks at Mubi, the streaming online curated movie service. Mubi is great. Mubi gives you 30 movies every month that you can stream to your phone, your tablet, your Apple TV, and all your other smart devices. You can download them to your phone, so if you're about to embark upon a beautiful trip across the Pacific Northwest, you don't need to be connected to Wi-Fi to continue to watch. What makes Mubi different from stuff like Netflix and Hulu's? Anyway, you can be assured that Mubi is going to curate only the best and the brightest cinematic gems from across the globe for your enjoyment. And they actually wanted to highlight this week their Direct from Locarno series. They have a festival going on now, and Mubi is going to exclusively present a series of films from 2015 and 16. And the films all over the world, including Colombia, Portugal, and France. So you can go there now to see the full lineup. And this whole month, they're actually doing a special tribute to Jacques Rivette.
Woo!
That was about to say, are we not going to give it up for Jacques? That's fine. Go to...
It's a blind spot, unfortunately.
It is. Well, guess what? If you have Mubi, you can rip that blind spot off. I don't know if blind spots are like bandages or scabs, but I'm just going to assume they are. They can be ripped off. So,
I think
rip
Dwell
off your
is on there
Rivette
right now.
Blind spot. And go to Mubi.com/filmstage, and you will be able to get a free month. In fact, I was telling people that they should tell us if they do this and tell us what they watched. And we have, this is probably not his name, Mark My Words, that's at Will MZY on Twitter, tweeted at me, said, hey, thanks for the free month. And I said, sure, tell us what you watched. He said, Hal Hartley's Trust. He loved it. Interesting dialogue scenes that felt quick and too scripted, yet strangely affecting. So... hit us up. Tell us what you're doing with your free month of Mubi, courtesy of us and our fine friends at Mubi. That's MUBI.com/filmstage. Whew. All right, guys, are we ready to talk about Pete's Dragon?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Mike, are you ready to talk about perhaps the first good movie you've gotten to speak about on this podcast?
I was only going a little crazy.
All right. Well, here is the trailer.
Your family?
I guess he was on a picnic or a camping trip. He wandered off and got himself lost.
Been out in the woods, doing things his own way. Sounds like a boy after your own heart.
How long has he been out there?
6 years.
Nobody can survive in that forest for 6 years. At least not alone.
You'll see. I have Elliot.
Who's Elliot?
I need to get back to him.
All right. So that is the trailer for Pete's Dragon. Newest live-action film from Disney Studios. This stars Bryce Dallas Howard, Robert Redford, Oaks Feigley, Wes Bentley, Carl Urban, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr.
Don't forget Una Lawrence.
Una? Is that how you say it? Una?
I think so.
That's the only way to say it, really.
I recognized her from Southpaw. She was fantastic in that film.
Well,
I saw her in Bad Moms a few weeks ago.
I think this is the first film I've ever seen her in, but I'm glad that we have such a track record with her. Una Lawrence also plays Natalie in this film. And this is from writer-director David Lowery. He's not the only writer, but he is credited screenplay. And
he's also a Texas boy.
He is.
And he's a vegan.
And Ain't Them Body Saints was one of my top 10 films of that year. I had been super eager to see what he did next, and then I heard he was directing Pete's Dragon, and I said, wait, they're doing a remake of that shitty Disney film that gave us Candle on the Water? Needless to say, I wasn't excited at first, but let's see how it turned out in the end. Michael Snydell, why don't you kick us off?
All right. Well, guys, I'm going to go with a really on-the-nose reference here, but what this really reminded me of was How to Train Your Dragon. And why I say that is that this is one of the best dog movies I've seen in at least a decade. Like, very few films in the past few years that have really reminded me about the connection you have to an animal and that you build. And just how that relationship ebbs and flows. And it's weird that Pete's Dragon does not take place over a long period of time, but you really feel that relationship. And there's a lot of visual references that I'm sure we're going to get into. I mean, this is like a resolutely 70s feeling film, but honestly, what really stuck with me is just how much that main relationship is continually built over and over. And besides being really damn adorable, like, you really feel that connection.
I'll agree with that.
But the rest of the movie in general was terrible?
No. I mean, I don't know how far you wanted me to go. No, sure.
That's a good start-off point. But
I guess one thing we'll definitely talk about more is it's, you know, this is arguably the beginning of the art house Disney period. You know, I know we're having Alex Ross Perry doing Winnie the Pooh.
Oh my God.
Ava DuVernay doing A Wrinkle in Time, and other ones that I'm totally forgetting. I mean, I guess you could say there was Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella last year, Jon Favreau's The Jungle Book, but these, we're now getting into the period where it's distinctly like idiosyncratic auteurs like Lowry and DuVernay who have like a very specific style, and they are working within the framework of a Disney movie. Like,
I wonder if DuVernay is going to be like, no, I only need half of that budget. I just want it small. I want it small.
Sure.
And it's got to start at playing on like 12 screens, and then we can kind of platform release.
Sure.
Yeah. I definitely agree. Like the Lowry specifically is someone that just has a very, very distinctive style. And right from the opening frames of this film, you get that sense.
Yeah, they don't try to like squash his style into some bland Marvel-esque house style, you know?
Well, it's so interesting that, like, I mean, Ain't Them Body Saints, like, I personally really love that film. Like, you too, I get the sense. But, like, it's a film that finds, like, poetry in vagueness. And like, this film is so interesting that it's able to retain that, like, enigmacy. To its imagery and things like that, but it also front loads like these very traditional Disney ideas of family, but also intertwines it with like the death obsessed viewpoint of Lowry.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love that you call him the death obsessed viewpoint. All right. Well, Bill Graham, let's kick it to you. What were your general thoughts on the quality of Pete's Dragon?
Sure. This is a film that I was talking with some friends, and they were mentioning that they didn't even realize that this was an actual movie until just a couple of weeks ago or just a couple of days ago when they saw a trailer for it. And they were like, wow, oh, that's a movie coming out. Interesting. So this film, I think, has really kind of skirted and stayed under the radar for a lot of people. But it is interesting. Michael was mentioning that there's a lot of these kind of Disney revival. But there's also, I mean, think about what Spielberg did this year. Think about some of the other films that are finally coming out. There's a lot of classics that are finally being turned into, big screen adaptions and things like that, and kind of updated effects. And I think this one, honestly, is the first one that really kind of nails it. It gets so many things right beyond just the character of the boy and the dragon. It does so much interweaving. It gives so much backstory to a lot of these other characters that another filmmaker wouldn't even bother to add in. I've got to say the one big issue that I have is actually the look and design of the dragon itself. And I get that is carried over from the book and everything like that.
Wait, there's a book?
I'm sorry, the animation.
It was in... Okay.
Wait.
Yeah.
There was an unpublished short story, and that became the treatment for the film.
Yeah. So...
For this film or the first one?
I'm sorry, for the original.
Okay.
For the Don Chafee one.
Now, Bill, are you saying that they carried over the imagery from the unpublished book, or...?
No, from the animation.
Really?
Hmm.
I don't believe that to be true.
small details and things like that.
His,
I mean,
like his underbite.
His underbite, but it's also got hair on top of his head and things like that.
I mean, he's covered
in hair. No, I'm talking about the animation.
Right, but I'm saying the similarities between the two basically are like the underbite.
Somewhat.
Okay.
Anyways, moving on.
You say like the similarities between the two, that you had an issue with the way this dragon was portrayed, but you think it has to do with being carried over from the old one. I think that, like, aside from being green and having an underbite, these two things couldn't be more different.
I'm inclined to agree with Brian.
I think you might not have a problem with, like, fealty to the original. You just might not like this design.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I misspoke. I'm looking at a couple more images of the dragon right now. And yeah, I guess for whatever reason, I remember him being much more dog-like in the animated movie. And so I guess I carried that over, but I haven't seen the animated movie in quite a while. So it's a little sketchy. It's fine. So whatever the hell they're doing with the animation, for whatever reason, why they gave it fur and things like that, I think that is probably my biggest sticking point for this entire film. And the fact that I'm picking such a small gripe. I mean, look, the film does kind of focus on a dragon, right? But it's like that small gripe kind of carries throughout the film. And yet I still absolutely fell head over heels for this film. I remember halfway through watching this and just thinking to myself, this is going to be a new classic. This is going to be something that a lot of the children in my packed theater are going to grow up reminiscing about, remembering. The fact that it's got some of these big name actors, Robert Redford is in this fucking movie, guys.
Like, and he's not just like there for a scene. He's like in this movie.
He is an essential part to the drama at the heart.
He's so great at this.
Might be one of my favorite performances of his in a while.
Yeah. He's fantastic in this movie. They did so much background work. And the way that the child interacts with the dragon, the way that the child interacts with his surroundings. I love that he's this kind of feral creature, but also has vocabulary and, you know, things like that. So he's not just this.
He's not a Mowgli.
Yeah, he's not just this creature that just can't get around in this world. He just doesn't want to be there.
Live by our rules, man.
Sure.
He's got a freedom of motion that most kids could only dream of.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, even down to some of the music that this film picks right from the outset, I was just struck and just in awe that this is a film that a major studio was behind. This feels like an indie that just happened to have a good amount of budget. This does not feel like a Disney film. I don't even know what that even means, but it doesn't it doesn't have any musical numbers in the middle of it. It just doesn't feel like it's hampered by anything other than his own imagination, Lowry's.
Yeah. You guys didn't feel Disney's hand at all?
No, not really.
Not really.
I mean, this is... I'll just jump in because the question was put out there. Even Disney's things that they've remade, like Cinderella and Maleficent and the Alice in Wonderland movies.
Oh, Jesus.
Like, they're big and they're fucking epic. And it's like, you know, Disney wants to make blockbusters out of its old properties. And this doesn't feel like a blockbuster. You know, they didn't get the special effects guy from another movie to just come and do whatever the producer told them. Sure. They gave David Lowery, of all people, who made Ain't Them Bodies Saints, which is, you know, not a PG movie. It's rated R. There's people dying it.
Let's be honest. I think Lowery went after this, right? It's not necessarily sure they went to him.
I think what they said was here's another guy like, you know, Colin Trevorrow or, you know, to a lesser extent, Rian Johnson. We should scoop him up because he's got this very palatable nature aesthetic instead of like Malick, where it kind of tries to keep you on the outside. And they said, we should give him something. And then when they said, you know, they probably had a general meeting and they said, you know, what in our slate, you know, looking back from like 80 backwards, what do you think speaks to you? And they probably had their jaws hit the goddamn floor when he said Pete's Dragon. Because I believe that he probably was like, you know, it's a movie that I could do something with, Pete's Dragon.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I don't remember seeing Pete's Dragon, but I've been told that I saw it. I've also been told that even as a child, I did not like it. And looking at screenshots of it, it's like a flat, disgusting looking movie with a dragon that is less than compelling looking.
Sure.
And he was like, let's turn this into a nature thing. Let's make the dragon an animal. Let's make it a boy and his dog story that encourages kids to like get out there and adventure and fucking have an imagination and mm-hmm. think about things. And that seems like the type of stuff that would appeal to the man who made Ain't Them Body Saints, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he fucking knocked it out of the park. I'm saying fuck way too much for a podcast about a PG-rated Disney movie.
Hey, we're just making it up, or making up for lost time, right? PG?
Yeah, pretty much.
So here we go. Here's the F-bombs.
So, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. It does not feel like the other Disney movies, where they're just like, let's just make an epic, you know, Snow White and the Huntsman style. Let's just throw mm-hmm. some stuff around. Because, like, if you wanted me to describe what I think a Disney's Pete's Dragon would be, you know, it would be the military comes after the dragon and there's like 400 Jesus. Dragons. And
man, yeah, you stole my fucking line.
I'm super sorry. Do you want to steal the better line that I did before we started talking, or have that one?
You still got that one.
Okay. And, I mean, here's the other thing. This movie doesn't really try to be subversive in a way that I think Disney wants a lot of these movies to be. It really does feel old-fashioned in a good way, not in a Trump's America kind of way, but, you know, it's about people who love each other and care about each other and want to do the best for each other. And the bad guy in the movie wants to do the best for himself because he doesn't in general feel like other people are looking out for him. He's not awful. He just is selfish in the way that I assume only a younger brother can be selfish, because he doesn't feel like his older brother has his back.
And he's kind of a ding dong. Like he's just kind of a ding dong.
He's a little bit of a blockhead.
Yeah, I kind of love the view of humanity in this movie in general. Like, all of the men are just fucking idiots. Like, it's just great.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's
the thing. Like, in this movie, there is, you know, a very heavily tilted towards the female point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not usually one who celebrates a movie just because it decides for representation or subversion of the usual heteronormative, masculine, white aesthetic. But this movie does that in a really good way, and it does it by not really drawing attention to itself. I mean, mm-hmm. Bryce Dallas Howard is a park ranger who is not just told, but we actively see her being, you know, independent, going her own way type of woman. And she finds Pete, and Pete immediately connects with this girl, Natalie, who...
Yeah.
sees a young feral boy in the woods and uh-huh. follows him and tracks him and then is able to climb a tree with him. You know, she's not a little girl who gets lost in the woods and he has to rescue her. Like, they're immediately on par with each other. And mm-hmm. it's the perfect kind of modernization in terms mm-hmm. of gender expectations without feeling like that's its only reason for being. It feels like it's taken that modern equal reality and just made it a non-issue, which is really the best way to do it. Michael, you were going to say?
What I was going to say is I think beyond gender things, I think this does a lot better, at least by Bryce Dallas Howard at the very least. But in general, I think it's so interesting that this film is such a celebration of, I don't want to call it intellectualism, but it's a sense that, like, it's interesting that even the scenes that have aggression, they're immediately neutered. Like, there's so many scenes that are about, you know, using a compass to go through the woods, or climbing trees, or just having, like, general respect for the things around you, that feels so distinctly unmasculine. Like, it's just a whole worldview.
I think it's Now we're going to get into the semantics of masculinity. This is like masculinity of a kind that people used to celebrate.
This is the lumberjack way, right?
Right. This is the frontiersman. Like, go out and discover and understand nature, but don't, you know, exploit it. Like, this is, and it's something that we've called masculinity for so long, but really we ought to just call humanity, because it's a celebration of curiosity and independence while at the same time having empathy. I mean, it's this beautiful amalgamation of all of these wonderful human traits that we don't see enough of in our general entertainment. You know,
I think
nowadays,
there's so much in the film that so many of the main characters are related to each other. Like, that's a little small
family dynamic. You know, it set place in a small town and everything like that. And that's kind of where a lot of this kind of home cooking kind of values kind of comes from. And I think it's interesting that Lowry is, I mean, he was raised in the DFW Metroplex, so it's not like he necessarily has this kind of
background. Do you want to tell the people at home who aren't from Texas what that is?
Oh, the DFW.
Because it sounds like you just described a post-apocalyptic apartment block.
Okay, so the DFW Metroplex is the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, which is basically Dallas and Fort Worth and all the surrounding suburbs and cities and things like that in the heart of Texas. And so, like, I don't know, there's 7-8 million people that live in this area, geographical area. So it's not like he comes from a small town. There literally are no small towns in DFW. Because you're in the middle of just, you know, the metropolis, right? So it's interesting that he has these kind of worldviews that he's bringing to this film. And I think what it may actually end up being, they filmed it in New Zealand, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And I think part of what this may be is he's an outsider. He is not the traditional director that Hollywood kind of picks up and you know, launches into the stratosphere. This is a guy that comes from a very kind of low budget, small indie film background. And I think maybe he's kind of bringing that mentality into the film. And it's interesting because he has moments where he explores some of the fun of and some of the wonder that's kind of happening, but it just never feels really over the top. It always feels subtle. It always feels like there is a genuine sense of wonder, and it's not, I'm just trying to show it to you. I'm just going to, you know, have this kid kind of go for a ride with that. It's a really interesting kind of take. And yeah, I think Brian kind of stole it, but there is a moment, especially towards the end, where it could make a right turn into a very normal, very obvious direction, and it never does. The other thing that I really, really enjoy about this film is that the dragon has a ton of personality.
Oh yeah.
It almost seems more human than even the boy does at times. Just his curiosity, his attachment to, and it almost seems like sometimes he understands what people are saying. There's just so much to unpack with this film that I just was not prepared for in a PG movie that lasted 102 minutes.
Yeah.
What is this?
In and out.
we're talking about all these things that this movie does. It should be stated, it's not a complicated story, and it's not 2 hours long.
No. Yeah.
It's 102 minutes, and it starts in a place, and it very rapidly and joyfully moves along, and there's never a scene that doesn't feed into the narrative in some way, either emotionally or plot-wise. But we also don't have, like, just a scene where people are having, like, a family dinner and saying, well, you know, you married my daughter, and you know, this is your brother who works for the logging company that you own, and no, you just kind of like get introduced to these people, pick it up on the fly, and it all moves with complete and utter ease and seamlessness, and it's really great. A friend of mine tweeted this morning that she saw Star Trek Beyond, and it was great to have a blockbuster movie this summer that didn't have like six needless side plots. And I said, you got to see Pete's Dragon, because there is not an ounce of fat on that movie.
Sure.
And
that's true.
It's so nice. It's so nice to just have a movie that has a story and tells it. And it's a story that's as simple as a picture book story that is featured in the film. But because it understands the inherent emotions in that story, it's able to tease it out and make it into something super affecting. I have a baby now, and this is actually the first time my... Yeah, Bill, oh my God. It's been a while. This is actually the first movie that I've taken my daughter to with my wife. Now, my baby is like 5 weeks old, so it's not like she's going to remember this. But just in general, like, this is perfect, and I'm going to be so happy when she's, like, 3 years old, and I can be like, this is the first time you ever entered a movie theater, and throw this onto the holographic video disc player, because I have a very long view of the future.
So one thing...
Pop her
one
into
thing...
her toddler VR goggles and just let her live in that world.
Emily won. Or Emily Prime.
Emily Prime. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Okay. So one thing I'm very curious, because it seems like, you know, we're throwing a lot of love at this film already. Mm-hmm. Did y'all see a lot of advertisements for it? Did y'all see a lot of kind of hype or anything like that coming into the film?
No. I mean, I had heard from critics and stuff that it was pretty good. I think Empire only gave it 3 stars, which was surprising.
Idiots.
Yeah, but I mean, no, I don't think, even I, as a man who loves dragons and loves David Lowery, even I was kind of like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was the exact same way. What I'm getting at is I just really don't understand why this film didn't have kind
the
of
push.
It's a fucking Disney movie. Like, what is going on here?
I
remember Lowery had got it, and then I just don't remember hearing anything about it until probably like a month ago.
Sure.
And that's when Jordan, our benevolent leader, basically messaged us and was like, hey, y'all got to go see this.
Yeah.
And we were like, okay, cool, done.
He was raving. You
know? Yeah. And if he hadn't told me to go see this, I don't know if I would have. And that's just really, really sad and kind of shocking to me that Disney is sitting on top of this film that I absolutely adore.
Bill,
and,
are they? Like,
I don't know.
Here's the thing that I always say with us and children's films is I don't think we're the target audience.
Oh, I watch a lot of cartoons, though.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go. I was about to say, I don't know if, like, this is getting real play on, like, Disney XD or...
Sure.
Okay, well, I guess I don't watch a lot of Disney XD, but I mean, I watch Cartoon Network, you know, probably.
But that's
same.
More of an adult. I don't know. The only thing I watch on Cartoon Network is Rick and Morty, and I don't feel like we're going to get a Pete's Dragon commercial in the middle of that.
No, I watch Steven Universe, I watch Adventure Time, I watch regular shows. So, yeah, there's like 3 or 4 shows on
stuff though.
Yeah.
I guess
definitely
I'll just be real. I don't know what the hell is going on with Cartoon Network.
it's gone through an ebb and a flow, and I think it's coming back pretty strong right now. There's some high quality animation out there that
for
really
children.
Yeah, for okay. children. That
okay,
that,
guys. Before we get totally derailed.
Well, yeah, because it is weird that I mean we couldn't get away from ID4R or BVS DOJ or.
Other
Suicide
acronyms.
Squad or some shit like that, and you know, here's a fucking good movie, and
sitting right at
thing.
The end. Yeah,
it's a little nice to not have already felt like this movie happened 3 years ago. To like walk in and not have seen everything. I mean, fucking Ghostbusters, Jesus! Even if that had been a good movie, I'd been hearing about it for so long, I was ready to just get it over with.
Sure.
Sure. And that's, I think that's part of the reason.
25.
I think that's part of the reason why watching this film felt like such an interesting, because I mean, honestly, because I hadn't seen a lot of trailers for it. And I mean, even the fact that Robert Redford was in the movie, I didn't know that until watching the movie. And then he pops up on screen and I'm like, holy shit. Okay. And then Carl Urban as well. I don't think I remember any of the casting before I actually saw the film. And that's kind of the way that I genuinely like to go see films, is not have everything kind of at my disposal and shoved down my throat. Sure. I want to watch it and discover who's in the film and how long it is. Like, a lot of times I don't like knowing how long a film is. Although I don't really wear a watch anymore, so it's not like I would be able to keep track of that anyways. But it's just one of those things where, yeah, it feels like a little small independent film that like nobody really knows about.
I hope it does well. I really do. Isn't Lowry being tapped for the next try at Peter Pan?
Yes.
I think he can do it.
He's attached to that.
I think after this movie, if he gets Oakes in there... the guy who played Pete, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, I think he could do it. I think as much as I was okay with Pan, which I know is a controversial opinion, I think that David Lowry doing Peter Pan with what he's shown us in this movie, I would say it's a lock. I'm already in the seat for that film. That's how much I enjoyed Pete's Dragon.
And Brian, I wanted to pick up on something you said a little bit earlier. So you said you were saying that it's not like subversive in a traditional way, but one thing I have picked up in the marketing is that like this is not at least the marketing was a little bit I don't know. It was kind of putting it more in line, at least for me, with something like Super 8, in the sense that I was thinking that it was going to be a lot of quick teases. And yeah. What I think is incredibly subversive about Pete's Dragon is it's within the first couple minutes that, yeah. like, it's funny because the first dragon shot, it's like kind of silhouetted. And then it's like, oh no, here's the dragon. You will see it for the rest of the movie. Don't worry about it.
I thought that at first too. In fact, if you've seen the trailer, there's a point where a young boy, his name is Pete, he is the boy, he jumps off of a cliff, and then you see him swoop up with the dragon, and that shot's in like the first 10 minutes.
For sure.
Like, it seems like that's going to be like, oh, the people are chasing him, they don't believe in Elliot, and they're going to like be, no, Pete, and then all of a sudden the dragon's going to go up and they're going to do the Spielberg face, but he's just alone and having fun with his dragon.
There's like whole sequences, by the way, that are just the dragon. Like, I'm thinking of the one specifically where he's out a window, outside a window, and he's just like, the camera is totally with him. The
dragon
whole
gets
time.
Independent character beats. Like, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Because a lot of films would be like, whatever, the fucking humans aren't with this dragon. No one's going to care about the dragon. And the dragon is like a puppy that's trying to find its owner, and it does, and it's beautiful.
And there's deep dignity to, like, him, as you're saying, him reacting without the humans.
Yeah.
Like, it's obviously about the humans that he's reacting, but it's not like, it just doesn't feel like a mess of CGI fuzz, like so many things do recently.
I would say also, just, you know, we were talking about the dragon being covered in fur. Like, that's a bold choice. Cause
for sure. It's a very bold choice.
Nothing is easier than just animating scales.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, no, fuck it. This thing has fur. And it's like, all right, well, that's an extra $20 million on our budget. And it could look goofy, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
And this is actually, I was watching this, and because Pete is such a dog, or not Pete, Elliot is such a dog, during the movie, I kept thinking of both of my dogs, but one in particular, Lightning, who has made appearances on this podcast because he barks so goddamn much. And last night I had to give both my dogs a bath, and I was just like giving my dogs a bath, and I was like, God, can you imagine giving Elliot a bath? Can you imagine how hard that would be? Like, this is crazy. And that's just how much this movie sold me on the relationship of Pete and Elliot, and just sold me on Elliot as a thinking, feeling entity.
for sure.
Yeah.
I'm really curious how they kind of made this film, because honestly, at times I was pretty damn convinced that they had a stand-in of some sort.
Right.
That was either a live model or just like a big block with like fuzz hair. Or hair on it. Yeah,
well, Bill,
something.
You remember I had that same question about The Jungle Book. Mm-hmm. With Baloo specifically when he's like in the river.
Yeah.
Yeah. Disney, man, I don't know who their effects house is, but both of these movies prove that they're doing something special.
Well, I'm looking at dragons in Game of Thrones.
Jesus. Yeah. Man. God. They need to up their game. Yeah. I would probably imagine it's Weta that was probably behind it, especially since it's over in New Zealand.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because I was going to say, like, it's not ILM, is it? Like, would it be ILM?
Where the hell would we even find this information?
I don't know. I'm sure it's somewhere, right?
It's weird you guys say Weta, because I was... I don't love Peter Jackson's King Kong, but the one scene that I always think about is the ice skating one.
Yes.
And that this at times feels like a lot of that, you know, the warm fuzzies of that movie just expanded into a whole movie. Like, there is a very specific sense of just a deep respect for all of these characters that just shows through the whole time.
Real quick, it was Weta Digital.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Well, good on them. All right. Well, do you want to jump into spoilers and we can talk more about the plot and what specifically we're talking about as far as these emotionally affecting moments that may or may not have made me cry?
Yes. Let's just go ahead and. Yeah, yes, go see this damn movie.
Yeah, go
just,
see it. It's fucking awesome.
It's good.
Yeah. I don't care if you have a kid or not.
It's fucking awesome.
It's one of the bright spots in this summer.
It really is a bright spot in this summer.
This is like I would have to go through and see what other movies I saw this summer, but this might be the bright spot of the summer.
This and The Shallows.
The Shallows. Yeah, that's a completely different style of movie. This is a boy and his dragon. That's a girl and her shark.
Hey, don't forget about Steven Seagal.
Yeah, man, this is come true. On.
Okay, so in the Oscar. For best friendly animal character to an imperiled person, who wins, Steven Seagal or Elliot the Dragon?
Elliot.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he's got more screen time, you know?
Seagal can get the supporting.
best supporting friendly animal to an imperiled.
He's got a killer name.
Oh, my God. All right, well, let's do spoilers for Pete's Dragon. We were talking about how Pete... is this something that you've noticed that you keep wanting to call the dragon Pete for some reason?
I don't know why, but I just call it Dragon, so...
Well, that's name on the poster, I guess. So Elliot, the dragon, gets his own little, like, dog trying to find his master moment, and it culminates with him doing it and finding Pete, and at this point he sees Pete in, like, a happy little family unit with... Bryce Dallas Howard's coward character of Grace and her boyfriend Jack and his daughter Natalie. You know, there's a blended family element here. And when Elliot sees them there and sees that Pete is fine and happy with these people, he like gets really sad and then goes home.
Yeah.
And I was like,
that was heartbreaking. That was
heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It was like crushing to me. I was like, oh no. Like, I was hoping that Pete would see him and run out to him and like invite him in for cookies or something. But I mean, that's the power of what this movie does with all the characters. Cause you see Pete in a happy circumstance and you're glad because he's found his people. But then you realize that like there's Elliot out there and he loves this boy and he's willing to let him be happy. It's so crushing in the best of ways.
I think the reason that scene really works well, and Bill, I think you were starting to say how well put together this feels, but there's such a like fluidity to the script in general that when you get to that moment, it doesn't feel like, oh, here's the moment. Like, there's not that predetermined feel that's mm-hmm. in so many. I mean, even The Jungle Book kind of suffered from this earlier this year. But, like, it's weird. I was thinking about the bus chase, for instance. And I was thinking about how – or excuse me, not the bus chase, but where
– Semi.
No, I'm talking about before that. Okay, I'm talking about when Pete is running away
from the
police. Or, he's running away from the hospital. Sorry. And, like, I was just thinking about this moment, and these don't feel like scenes. They're so fluid in the way they move. And, you know, it's like – okay, from the hospital into this chase sequence, he gets caught here, and then he ends up, you know, with the family for a bit. And then, you know, it's just put together in such a way that you are feeling that absence of, you know, Elliot or something. But then when Elliot comes in, it's like the film still feels so interconnected, even without these main characters.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I was going to say with relation to what you were saying about how it doesn't feel like, okay, here's the moment. A lot of these summer films have action beats that you could excise entirely and lose nothing. I mean, I know that we've kind of as a society already forgotten that Suicide Squad happened, but most of the fights in that movie are completely pointless. And
yeah.
Like in the event of Harley Quinn and her elevator fight, literally seem to have been tacked on out of nowhere and serve nothing and do nothing and just like sort of happen as though your disc skipped and went to a brand new scene. And in this, you know, that in this is what trailers do, but it really seemed like him running from people and being on the bus was going to be a big thrilling escape moment. And it is, but it's a lot quieter than you expect. I mean,
absolutely.
It's scored not with, like, rapidly screaming violins and, like, threatening cellos, but this very gentle folk song that makes him dodging the police and escaping on a school bus and jumping onto a pickup truck not thrilling, but sort of, like, wondrous and awe-inspiring, which is a very counterintuitive way to play that scene. Because you're not threatened by it. It never feels like, oh, I hope he's going to be okay. It's like, no, this is like him and Elliot romping through the woods.
I guess you're getting at something, too, that like there's an urgency in these. Like, even if there's not, you know, the regular sense of danger, like Pete's Dragon really has an urgency to the whole film itself. Because even when, you know, you're not actually worried that Pete or Elliot are going to hurt themselves or something. I don't know what I'm getting at here.
Okay. So since we're in spoilers, I want to mention a few things really quick.
Okay.
One thing that was really kind of striking to me was there are little moments with the dragon itself. He flies pretty well until he just absolutely doesn't. And for whatever reason, he just like dive bombs out of the sky, and
he's not a very aerodynamic creature.
No, and they kind of make that pretty obvious in the film, but there's almost moments where I thought that he was injured in some way, and that's why he kept staying in this one kind of central area. You know, I thought he was kind of almost hiding. In a way that he just wasn't to his full capabilities. And there's a lot of things going on with this dragon that they don't bother explaining, that they don't really go into details of. And yet I was just completely okay with that in so many different ways. That would be so frustrating because I would want to know the answers. I would want to know why, but I think this is a sign of really good filmmaking in that they give you enough character and story behind the dragon itself that you don't get hung up on some of the bigger or smaller details, whichever way you want to kind of view those. Apparently, it can camouflage itself. It can become crystal clear. Again, never explains how, never explains how that works at all. And the other great thing is that this kind of gives a reason. Now, look, it's a very large dragon. It's probably, what, 25 feet tall, something like that. It's a really big, like, animal. And yes, the fact that it can large. The fact that it can live in the jungle or in the forest without anybody noticing is kind of, oh, okay, you know, that's kind of crazy. But the fact that it's camouflaged really kind of helps sell that, okay, maybe it just knows what to do.
Well, yeah, I wanted to say, I mean, I had that same thing. I was like, how the hell is this thing just not being found? And then it can camouflage itself. And what's beautiful about this movie is that it gives the forest the scale that it needs to hide this thing. Mm-hmm. It makes the forest feel really primeval. And then when he becomes invisible, you can kind of see that there's a glimmer to him that looks mm-hmm. like motes and little springtails and stuff just flittering through the sunlight. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, like, that's such a cool thing for if, and I'm sure that this is something that kids will see and pick up on. And then when they're out in the woods, they can see that themselves and think, oh my God, is that a dragon?
Sure.
Like, and I am super fucking amped to show this to my daughter and then take her out to the woods and see if I can convince her that there's a dragon out there.
So there's a moment specifically with that camouflage where there's some birds in like a little nearby tree where Elliot is. And all of a sudden, Urban, because Carl Urban has basically, he's the first person to kind of run into the dragon and the first person to kind of track it down, outside of Pete, obviously. But so there's a moment where the dragon is kind of going through the forest, and I think Urban is kind of tracking him. And there's these birds in this tree that all of a sudden, for what Urban is kind of looking around at, just all of a sudden jump out, like they all like scatter out of this tree. And it's because Elliot is right next to them, right? They are aware that there's a dragon right there, and they're like, I'm out of here. Like, and yet, if you've ever gone to a forest, if you've ever gone to a park, if you've ever done some of this stuff, you can be walking around and all of a sudden birds will just take off for no apparent – it's not like you stepped on a stick and broke it and right. It made a loud noise and then they fluttered away. No, mm-hmm. Sometimes just out of nowhere, they will just all as a group just get up and go. And you're like, why are y'all flying away like that? And
usually
this,
in a movie, that means bad things are happening.
Yeah,
sure. But in this movie, I think it just kind of builds a lot of that kind of, it is interesting the way that you're kind of explaining that, Brian, because yeah, it's like, oh man, like if you're a small child, this is gonna just spark so much interest in. You know, things like that, the little mysteries of kind of a forest or a park or
whatever. This movie does a really good job with Robert Redford's character, who we have loved to earlier and I'm going to give more to now, because he's this kind of old guy who's a woodworker, and the kids like run to his workshop to hear him tell stories about when he saw a dragon.
He's like a much gentler version of a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
If this were a horror movie, he would own a gas station and
only have one eye.
And the kids would all be horny teenagers. But as it stands, because this is again a PG-rated Disney movie, he tells this story and it's, you know, filled with, you know, the thing grabbed my gun and tore it apart and I plunged my knife into it, and he's telling this, you know, tall tale to scare these kids, and then you find out that his daughter's been hearing this for a while and, you know, he's pumped it up, but he believes that he had this real experience, and it's caused a bit of a rift between them because it's a general difference in their worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And when he tells the real story about what happened.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Oh my God. Again, another moment where I like nearly had tears in my eyes, and he's like, you know, you don't have to believe me. Just be open to it. And then when she decides to take Pete back into the woods.
I lost it.
And she's like, I think we should go pick up someone else who might want to, you know, mm-hmm. see Elliot. And then it cuts to the to the dad right next to her smiling. Because I was like, she's not doing this just to make a kid feel better. She like believes that maybe this might happen.
Yeah.
Oh,
and it's such a turning point for her own belief, because I think what happens is once Pete and her father kind of so what happens is basically Pete draws this picture of Elliot, and he tells Natalie about it, and Natalie shows the picture to her mom and is like, check this shit out, like he drew a dragon, like this is crazy. And so it's got like hair, it's got fur, and just kind of the general design. And so when she goes to her father's workshop to kind of look for this image that he had drawn, and sure, compares them, and all of a sudden sees the striking similarity between them, similarities that I think it's interesting, because the use of the fur makes this a very distinctive creature that if you were to ask someone normally to draw a dragon, they wouldn't have fur. So the right. fact that Pete and her father both drew fur on this, and you know, I don't know what people in this movie's reality think a dragon looks like, but if it's how most people think a dragon looks like, if one kid drew a furry green creature and another man drew a furry green creature, I'd be like, okay, this is weird. Let's talk about this. Like, this is more than just a coincidence.
Going back to what Michael said about him being a conspiracy theorist, I mean, like, that's why people think that stuff like Bigfoot exists, because it's like, oh, all these different cultures, they all have this story of a man ape.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, an interesting way to do that. Another thing to touch on in that same way, there's so much in this movie and it's just kind of overwhelming. Just the way that like both him and that girl, since they're about the same age, have that same really simple children's book.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
she's my MVP, by the way. I think
we've not talked enough about Una Lawrence.
She's fantastic.
She's so great in this. When again, she sees him, gets out of the car and chases him down, and I was like, she's not just being like, hey, there's a boy over there. Like, what's happening? Like, we have to help him. She's like, who is this fucking kid? And then, you know, is climbing the tree ably. And she's like, wow, you're really good at this. This is awesome. And then she gets hurt and she's like, she's not like,
I love
wounded
it. I
and
love
helpless.
It.
She's like pissed off at him.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love how he tries to touch it. Doesn't he try to touch it? And she's like, I'm hurt. What
I'm hurt, dick. This is your fault. And she's just great in this movie. She's a great scene partner for him. Those two freaking kid actors have gotten so good recently.
No,
they've found some really really good kid actors lately. The other thing that I wanted to kind of touch on is again going back to Elliot and his kind of design. He really really. You know it's a dragon, right? And so you know there's probably going to be a scene where he breathes fire, right? That's
a moment.
That caught me off guard.
See, and that's something that you're just like, okay, so this is probably going to happen. And yet his character, the way they kind of they have all of these people poking him, prodding him, doing all these terrible things to him. Just generally like being a nuisance to him, kind of, I mean, all he wants to do is just hang out with his buddy, right? Like that's all he wants to do. He ain't hurting nobody. You never see him actually eat anything. I don't know what the hell he's subsisting on. Maybe he just subsists on the touch of the boy.
You know, that would be an interesting movie if like love kept him alive.
Yeah.
Because when they touch him, he does light up. Oh, this is an interesting idea, Bill.
Yeah, and he becomes much more healthy at that point.
You know what? I was going to say, if we really wanted to be assholes about this, we could like find pictures that show his teeth and do a regression using other animals' teeth and see.
Okay.
You know, like I'm looking at a picture of his teeth right now because there's a screen cap of him roaring. And he does have teeth very much like my dog's. So I think he may have a canine-like diet, which means he may eat living creatures.
Yeah, I don't know, but they never really touch on that. But there's a moment in this film where you just start to realize that this creature just really doesn't have any reason to be. It's gotten by pretty much on its size alone, being intimidating, and the fact that the humans just straight up are like, you know, Carl Urban. I mean, it's Judge Dredd, right? I guess he can hold his own, but the fact that he just, when they first run into the dragon, they kick it into high gear and they are out of there, right? They're running as fast as they can, and yet for some reason they come back with like dart guns and they're like, cool, let's take this mother down. And you're like, no, don't do it. What are y'all doing? So I thought it was kind of interesting that they did kind of turn on him. But like I said, they keep prodding him, they keep kind of antagonizing him, and yet he never really shows any kind of aggression towards anyone until kind of that final moment. And that was the way they built that up. It was so heartbreaking because you could tell more than likely even Pete hadn't seen that side of Elliot. Sure. In the 5 years that they were kind of together. And it was this moment where it reminded me so much of the Iron Giant when Hogarth sees him finally kind of unleash this this kind of monstrosity of like firepower, and he's just like, that's not you. That's not the person I've been around for the last, you know, in this case, 5 years. Yeah. And so I thought the way they built that up and the way that scene kind of unfolds is just absolutely so beautiful, and it's such a great way to kind of in this world where we have the Batman versus Superman, where the only thing you wanted was just Superman to say, hey, he's got my mom, let's talk about this, let's work together, like let's just use our words, right? And here's this dragon that doesn't have the ability to use words, and yet it's holding back this awesome power the entire time,
right, for as long as it can.
Yeah. What's so interesting about that scene too, guys, is like, you know, like it's a nice effects shot, but it's interesting that it's so much less
computer background.
It's so much more disinterested in the effects work than the close-ups of the characters.
Yes.
Like the fact that we see like someone like Redford or Robert Redford's character like tearing up at this idea as he does this and sees the anger, or and we see Pete and we see, oh shoot, other characters' names. Una Lawrence.
Natalie,
and, Natalie and Grace, and just the camera spends a lot more time on their faces than the actual fire. Even though that's a cool effect shot in general.
And to that point, not only that, but these aren't the kids who are in danger.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a movie like this, it would usually climax with something like, oh no, Pete's in danger and Elliot has to save him.
Sure.
Pete's never really not in control. And the people who are imperiled are, you know, Pete's surrogate mother figure and Natalie's actual father.
Sure. Yeah, the nice people, right?
Yeah. And also the people who would ostensibly, you know, be the adults and in control of a situation. And so you're seeing the need in a child for their parents and for that relationship. And that imperiling that is a lot more affecting and nuanced than just, we might kill this kid, which is what usually happens. And also the turn that Carl Urban has at that point.
Oh, man, his character beat is just great there.
Oh, my God, when he realizes that that's his brother and just, like, runs over and is trying to help. I was like, oh, man, like, that's the perfect thing to kind of snap him out of this. This
selfishness
state he's in of selfishness. Yeah, because again, I mean, there's a point, and this is one of the things that I love about movies, is you can see the point when everything could have gone okay.
Yeah.
And you know, if it weren't for Wes Bentley's character Jack just kind of giving his brother the brush off, you know, Carl Urban, who plays Gavin, might not have rushed out and been like, you know what? Fine, fuck you. I'm going to show you. Again, I'm cursing way too much for the podcast about a PG movie. But
you're just so excited.
It's a really good movie, and I'm going to speak in my usual enthusiastic colloquial way, and that's just the way.
Say fuck a lot.
Yeah. So, and it's great how, you know, family dynamics inform so much of this, but they don't have to be, you know, your usual Warden June Cleaver family. They get to be the kind of messy families that we see out in the world. And that's really well done with Grace and her father, because there's obviously not estrangement, but a fundamental lack of a similar worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment when she sees Elliot for the first time, you know, she kind of curls up against her father, like, you know, you would do with your father if you're scared and you feel like he might be able to protect you.
Yeah.
No, it's...
But it doesn't undermine your character, too, which is a testament to the building before that.
Exactly. She doesn't turn in fear. It's awe and wonder. And suddenly, like, okay, Dad, you got, you know, a little more experience with this than me. So what happens now? And, he talks about the magic of seeing this thing and how it changed the way he viewed the world, including his wife and his daughter. And I was like, I get that, man. I've fucking been there, where you see something that overwhelms you and suddenly makes you look at everything different. And it's a great movie that celebrates that and puts it into a creature that doesn't exist, but frames it through a narrative that wants you to celebrate the simple idea that it could.
Sure.
Which is fantastic. And then there's that final scene, mm-hmm, where they go further north and they find Elliot with his family. And I was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
That was a beautiful, simple, like powerful way to end this movie. Cause I was like, they can't leave this movie on the, and they never saw each other again. Mm-hmm. Cause that just didn't, that would have been fine for a different movie, but this movie definitely felt as though it needed that moment where it lets you know that this relationship is still happening.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's evolved at the same time.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, if you view Pete and Elliot as a kind of switch-off family unit,
mm-hmm,
it's the point at which the father lets the son go or the son lets the father go or... Did they ever actually establish Elliot's gender? I don't think they do. I think they even make a point of saying, we don't know what the hell this is. But, you know, it's just, you know, they've both found their new families, but those are still intertwined in a way, and they will always have that bond that they shared. And it's beautiful.
Guys, yeah. I don't want to rain on the parade. I think I do. I get the sense that you guys really love this movie. I do like it. I do think the script is a little bit, I've been thinking about this all
choose week. Your words carefully.
I was about to say, you already know that I'll curse in favor of this movie.
No, I know, you definitely will curse. I do think, I like the folktale elements a lot, as we're talking about, but I do think that some of them are over-articulated. I think that things like the car accident at the beginning I find really beautiful, and the way that the storybook intersects. Some of those things are just... I couldn't decide one thing that I would take out, but I do think that some of those themes are a little bit overwritten into the dialogue and the symbolism. And I think that is... inklings of a Disney house style when Lowry's style was so impressionistic. So I do think that it does. So many other things are so smart, and so many of the themes are so well deployed. But I did feel the hands of.
Maybe not even Disney necessarily, but sure. maybe he was in a way he understood what when he signed up to make Peach Dragon, he knew he would have to do, and that was adapt his own style to make it a little bit more easy to swallow. I think the other half of it is also he probably knew that he was making a children's film. So it's not only just a Disney film, it's also a film that's going to be aimed primarily towards children. And I know a lot of filmmakers don't really like saying things like that. They like to say, oh, I'm just making this movie that pleases me. Right. The fact that it just happens to be for children, that's marketing, right?
Sure.
And I understand as an how an artist would feel like that would sound very just kind of against everything that they were for. But at the same time, I think everybody just kind of understands the game that they're playing, right? And everybody understands that I can't just make this crazy impressionistic film that's going to be sold to children. I have to be responsible.
Hitchcock so great was that he worked really well for his own style within the parameters of the studio system.
Yeah,
sure. I mean, that was,
I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah. But the biggest thing I think is there are moments like the film starts with Elliot in the car and as Pete in the car as his parents are talking to him, and this big tragic accident happens, and the way that is shot is absolutely stunning. It's a great way to get it's a great way to kind of get around the fact that, okay, I'm going to show you some death, but I'm not going to show you some death. You're going to have to kind of go with this, right?
But there's also lines about the definition of adventure. Like some of those things, and they don't show up very often, and that's perhaps why I'm getting, bothered by them a little bit more, is what you're saying is there's so many great things that those – things do feel a little bit like, this is a tiny bit overwritten at parts.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really deny that, but at the same time, I don't have too much of an issue with it.
Well, my
because
point,
it doesn't happen that often.
My point about the car sequence is the unfortunate fact that it is repeated later in the movie towards one of the final shots, and I. That was one of the few moments where I really was like, I really don't like this. I don't like that you're even hinting at the fact that this tragedy may happen again with his new family. Because that is what you're doing by shooting it the exact same way. From Pete looking towards his family as they're looking back towards him, kind of every now and then taking their eyes off the road, and you're like,
don't
even hint that this is going to happen.
I think that's what it was doing, though. I think it was saying that even though you may lose the people that you see as your family, you can find — this is going to sound awful at first, so hold on — you can find a new one, and that they will be able to give you not the same thing, obviously, because they're different people, but they'll be able to give you a similar thing in their own special way.
And I understand
it's a continuation rather than a threat of a repeat.
I don't mean that it's an actual threat. What I mean is the way that you shoot it, the fact that it's the exact same kind of —
it's a mirror.
It is. It's an exact mirror, and that feels very unfortunate. They could have — I mean, look, guys, we've seen scenes in cars a thousand different ways, right? There's a lot of different ways that they could have shot that wouldn't hint at that possibly happening again, that wouldn't hint at this, and it would still hold that meaning. Now, at the same time, what I'm thinking is maybe they did that scene so they could show that Elliot isn't freaking out about being in a very similar scenario where he lost his parents the first time, right? So I think there's both good and bad, but I just remember seeing that sequence and just saying, why even choose that same exact shot? I don't understand. I don't understand what the point is, unless it is about kind of moving on. And I still think you could do it in a much more subtle way of just having a shot of the family in the car. Like, it doesn't have to be the exact same shot, you know?
I didn't have a problem with it. That I do love that, you know, Michael, earlier you said death-obsessed David Lowery, and now Bill is like, he's holding a knife to our character's throat and saying, you want to see me do it again?
Yeah. I mean, what a way to end a Disney movie, right?
I would love that. I would actually love that if you just had them get in a car crash again.
I mean, guys,
and this time Pete dies too.
Oh man,
that's real fucked up.
What if it was Elliot that caused it?
I was about to say, you know, and that's something crazy that in like another movie that kind of thing might happen.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, oh, you know, Elliot somehow caused the first one, and like, you know, there's never a moment where like when Elliot sees Pete being happy, I kept dreading that, like, now Elliot's gonna like run away from him, and then Pete's gonna get in trouble, and the hunters are gonna like try to use Pete as bait or something. But no, like, Pete goes into the cave, and I guess he just says, hey man. And then Elliot's all like, what's up? I thought you had a family. And he's like, yeah, you want to meet him? We're still bros, bro. And then they just come out and everything's fine until Carl Urban shows up with a gun, as is so often the case in life.
Yes.
So yes.
Let's talk it out, guys. Let's talk it out.
Indeed. So I would say, from story to acting to effects to pacing to editing to camera work to all manner of things related to direction and music choice, Pete's Dragon, A+, 5 stars. I can't think of a reason. There's like, I had no problems with this movie. And as far as movies that are made for, I would call this a family movie more than a children's movie. Like, this is as good as they can get, really.
As far as I'm concerned, I agree. Yeah. This is definitely top of the line kind of filmmaking and design and everything like that. Two things quickly. We do have to mention Wes Bentley and his character, because I don't think we've gotten to mention that yet.
Well, as you said, Bill, he has like zero effect on the narrative.
Yeah, he is just in this movie, just doing a whole lot of nothing.
I'm
pretty sure this was a very easy vacation in New Zealand for him, because he's also just not in that many scenes. And
no, he's got like. I could probably name them all off, but I won't. But I mean, he's, we were talking about this before we started rolling, mm-hmm. and I brought up that for all intents and purposes, Wes Bentley has what 20 years ago would have been the wife's role in this movie.
20 years ago, dude. Last year.
Yeah, probably, or, you know.
This year.
Yesterday, honestly. Yeah. 20 years ago, it would have happened and no one would have mentioned it. And now, you know, we've had points where people have brought up, like, what was last year? It was the summer of
Jurassic World.
Yeah, that one woman. I can't remember her name.
What's her name?
I can remember
Kitty from Arrested Development.
Yeah, I was going to say Kitty, Cheryl. I can remember every character name she has. Yeah, but
she's wonderful. I can't remember her name, though.
Yeah, but I will say that, like, she was just, like, the mom in, like, 3 different movies.
Yeah.
And it was really depressing. And in this movie, you've got Wes Bentley, who's just like, I'm just here to be the parent that you can shuffle the kids onto whenever you've got stuff to do for the plot.
Judy Greer, I guess.
Yeah, Judy Greer. Wes Bentley has what Judy Greer would have had last summer. And, you know, he's got his things with his brother. But really, he just shows up looking concerned and loving and confused. And that's, you know, it's fine. He does that well.
You know, one thing I thought was really interesting, and I don't know if it says more about the script or his performance, but his body language towards Pete is very interesting. So in the sense of, like, you know, when Pete stays with Grace and the other person.
Grace and Jack and Natalie?
Yes, I'm sorry. When he stays with Grace, Jack, and Natalie, like, Jack knows to be a little bit not distant, but knows that he can't, like, overwhelm him. And I felt like that was something that was really genuine, and especially for a movie that, like, you know, it doesn't become a larger plot line, but there's talk about social services and things or something like that. And you get a sense that these characters do have, like, a sense of how not necessarily children, but how people communicate with each other, like, on a deeper level in terms of body language and what it means to be family and what it means to be close friends. Like, the film seems to have a really good sense of that.
Well, it is interesting that you mentioned some of that stuff, because there's a moment, especially when they have Elliot captured, where they really – where Pete is just kind of having to trust all of these adults to make a good decision on Elliot's behalf. And there's just kind of this uncertainty of childhood that's kind of encapsulated in that moment, where you're just like – okay, I guess you're making the best decision for me, but I don't have a say in any of this, you know? Mm-hmm. And the way our world kind of works is it takes away the independence of children a lot. It doesn't give them a choice in a lot of these scenarios. And especially when child services is going to show up, they're just not going to give him to Bryce Dallas Howard and Wes Bentley. Like, that's right. Just not going to happen. They're going to have to go through a lot of hoops. They're going to have to, like, do a lot of things. And it's just sure. like that. That's not a certain kind of ending that they kind of give you nice and neat in this film. And I understand that's the reality of just making a movie and everything like that. But, you know, there is kind of a darker side that this film
recognizes reality.
Yeah,
I think one of the smartest things this film did was actually not show who the social services person was.
Yeah. Yeah, they don't have to cast that person.
No, you have the car there. She sees the car. She knows that somewhere inside that building is a bureaucrat who has Pete's best interests in heart.
Sure.
But not as intimately as she does. Cuz like what people would you go after for that role? You'd be like, well, they need to be scary and mean and evil. Or you go the other way and it's like, oh, they're like super nice but kind of ditzy and don't really listen to Pete when he talks about having a dragon. And so they're like the airheaded adult who just like doesn't care that this kid is saying something. Or you go for the fat, bumbling Chris Farley type who's like, oh, I can't find my papers and this kid has tied my shoelaces together and now he's running away from me. Oh, what do I do? And it's just like, no, just don't bother. Just have that there and have that be a thing for her and never even let Pete know that that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was a good choice.
Yeah, I really think that works really, really well.
Or you get Tilda Swinton to reprise her role from Moonrise Kingdom, and then everyone is happy.
Oh, man.
All right. Guys, are we done?
I want to mention one last thing. It's very brief, but I want to say, like, we've talked about how much awe and wonder there is in this film. This film is actually really funny, too. Like,
oh,
there's
my God,
a sight gag with the stretcher that's, like, I've probably laughed harder than anything this year.
Did you see the old ladies are sitting at the diner, and when the dragon on the stretcher gets rolled by the server is pouring coffee and then pours it into the old lady's lap.
Yes.
And what does the old lady do? She slaps
the server. The waitress in the stomach. Like, hey, what are you doing?
And then
the old ladies look at each other and they're like, can you believe this?
She just poured coffee on me. Like, what a jerk. And you're like,
I think,
did you not just see the dragon?
You know what's funny is I think it's even more. I think she's pouring water into the glass, then she, because she's turning, was it the dragon that she was looking at, or was that when Pete was running through?
I think it is Pete.
She is pouring water and then she turns to follow Pete and she starts pouring it into that woman's bowl and then she turns even more and pours it on the woman, and the woman's just like, well, this is completely unacceptable. No, there's a lot of great little stuff like that, and they make this town, you know, not a Mayberry type place, but like a very fleshed out, interesting little town.
I mean, they didn't like let Isaiah Whitlock say shit, but you know,
he's got like two or three scenes, and he does good work in them.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
there are some just little comedic touches in this film that are just outstanding.
Yeah, no, this is a sure. film that has thrills, chills, laughs, and and everything you could want in a summer movie that's ostensibly for kids, but is, you know, great for the whole family. And like I said, A plus in my book. I can't think of a reason why someone wouldn't like this film.
I just can't help but be the ghost bro over here, right? The Ghostbusters bro, and just be like, man, they ruined my childhood of dragons. Okay. They gave them fur, and now all these kids running around talking about dragons.
Have the wrong idea about dragons.
Yeah,
they're
not gonna have scales,
about.
They're gonna have fur, man.
We should be talking about dragons as portly people with fucking wings the size of an iPhone. Which is what the fucking original Pete's dragon looked like.
Don't forget his toupee on top.
Oh yeah, he's got that shit toupee like George and Seinfeld. No, I mean, yeah, Bill, when you said that, I like immediately Googled the original Pete's dragon. I was like, I gotta correct this because this is bananas.
It's an ugly fucking dragon.
Terrible dragon. And I haven't seen that movie in forever, but God, it looks bad. But this is something that Roger Ebert had talked about, I think, where he said, like, why do we keep trying to make good movies? Like, we should go back and find the bad ones that we screwed up and, like, really work on getting them right.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you still have kind of the name recognition behind it, right?
Yeah.
I can't wait until they remake Batman versus Superman.
That should be a roundtable discussion in honor of Pete's dragon. Every one of us brings one terrible movie that we'd like to see remade and gotten right.
Yeah, you know what? I'm going to bring Scarface. Is that good?
After I just wrote like 1,000 words.
No, I know. I read your piece, Brad. It was good. I'm just fucking with you guys.
All right. Well, that's all for today. Before we say our goodbyes, let me remind everyone about Mubi.com. You can get your free month of Mubi, the curated online cinema service, by going to Mubi, that's MUBI.com/filmstage. Sign up there for 30 days. You will get free, unlimited access to their fine 30 film deep library. Don't get lost on Netflix and Hulu trying to figure out what's actually good. Mubi has taken the guesswork out of cinema by giving you a wonderful selection of 30 films every month to look at. Every day introduces a new film, and you got 30 days to watch it. You have no excuses. And remember, they're doing that Direct from Locarno series, and that is from the 3rd to the 13th. So the sooner you sign up, the more Locarno films you can see.
I think there's a film stage. Isn't it Ethan Vespi who's actually at Locarno right now?
Yes.
Nice.
So he's checking out the new ones, and we are giving you some of the old ones here with Mubi. That's MUBI.com/filmstage. Whew. Gentlemen, it's been fun. I'm glad we finally got to talk about a movie positively.
Woo!
And it's just as long as all the other episodes we've done. So apparently,
It's actually somehow shorter.
Slightly shorter than Suicide Squad. We can talk about good and bad movies in equal amounts. That's a good thing to realize about yourself. It would have sucked if this was like 30 minutes long and we were just like, yeah, it's fine. What is there to talk about? All right, well, let's tell the fine people where you can be found at home. Michael Snydell, start us off.
Well, you can see me rant and rave on Twitter.com at Snydell. And you can read reviews, features, interviews, etc., whatever I feel like writing, at The Film Stage and Pace Magazine.
All right. Bill Graham.
You can find me over in that mountain range where all the other dragons are. Chilling out and asking them how they can camouflage themselves so well. You can also find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can find me writing about movies for The Film Stage and also freshfiction.tv.
All right. And you can find me every day on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. And you can find me on The Film Stage where we just published our 50 comedies of the new century. Check that out. Yell at us. Tell us what we got wrong. I'm sure that will probably play into our roundtable as well. Speaking of which, look out for our roundtable episodes. They happen every other week. We have a new one happening this week. I don't think we have our topics locked down, so I can't plug those. We also have our running Scarface retrospective, not Scarface retrospective, Brian De Palma retrospective, which I have given so far two items to. So read up on what I think are the best attributes of the Untouchables and Scarface over at thefilmstage.com.
Yeah, I got one coming out this week, too.
Which one are you doing?
You should know this.
I really should. Good thing I totally watched it already. I wrote about Dress to Kill a bit ago. That I can plug that.
Okay. And I'll have Passion coming out soon, so that should be fun. It's a real weird film. Looking forward to watching it again. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. Guys, what are we talking about next week? Kubo, the Two Strings?
Ooh, I think so.
That does. I've heard so many good things about
that.
Right.
Well, we'll keep up our string of children's films, hopefully next week with less cursing.
I don't know. I may watch Sausage Party in between. So.
Oh, my God. All right.
I might like to see that, too.
My wife and I were talking about that. It's like, so do you want to watch Sausage Party? And it's like, yeah, kind of. All right. So maybe we'll have a little bit of that next week along with Kubo and the Two Strings. Whew. It's going to be busy. We look forward to seeing you all next week.